to fight. Do you? Do you? Today is Friday, December 16th. I am Chirag Mahajan, and you're listening to News 101. Broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. To the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to our listeners of our newscast and podcast on the internet. I apologize for running a little late here, but that's okay. I'll get straight to the local news. And also today, we will have a live in-studio discussion with Alexandra Say and Samantha Clark, two senior student researchers from the School of Communication at Simon Fraser University, who are part of a team of students at SFU that recently came out with a report on the top 25 underreported news stories in the past year. We will talk about a variety of topics, including the need for news reporting that is not afraid to push the boundaries of public information, and the importance of independent journalism in our digital world. Stay tuned for that discussion after our local news. You're listening to News 101 right here on CITR. And now for the local news. This Thursday, Dr. Christy Miller, head of molecular genetics at the Federal Pacific Biological Station in Nanaimo, publicized evidence regarding a Pacific variation of infectious salmon anemia, or ISA, virus. According to Dr. Miller's recent report to the Cohen Commission of Inquiry, suggests that this salmon virus appears to have been in the BC wild salmon for at least 25 years. The ISA virus has already triggered devastating disease outbreaks in stocks of farmed Atlantic salmon around the world. The ISA virus, or possibly a new variation of it, has been found repeatedly in samples of wild sockeye and pink salmon. Dr. Miller said her tests found a virus that is 95% similar to the European strain of ISA, which has infected farmed Atlantic salmon in Norway, Scotland, Atlantic Canada, and Chile. The ISA disease can be lethal to Atlantic salmon, but lab tests suggest it does not kill Pacific salmon. However, the Cohen Inquiry continues to look into this matter to see how BC wild salmon are reacting to the virus. According to a new study by University of British Columbia researchers, almost two-thirds of pregnant women in BC filled at least one drug prescription while they were expecting. The prescription drugs were mainly antibiotics, respiratory drugs, and drugs that act on the nervous system. The study of more than 163,000 pregnancies between 2001 and 2006 found that 63.5% of women filled at least one prescription during pregnancy. 1 in 13, or 7.8% of women, were prescribed drugs that carry some risk to the unborn child, including medicines for anxiety, insomnia, depression, which could have affected more than 12,600 pregnancies. The study's co-authors, Steve Morgan and Jane Daw, have said that because few drugs are given to pregnant women in clinical trials and safety testing, most of the drugs come to market before their effects on the fetus are known. The city of Vancouver is facing a $52 million gap in its preliminary 2012 budget, with a projected increase in operating costs and a decline in some revenues. On Thursday, Chief Financial Officer Patrice Impe told City Council that expenses are projected to increase by $62 million, or 6%, while total revenues are anticipated to go up by just 1%. The City Council's discussion marked the early stages of the 2012 budget process. City Manager Penny Balam said that public consultation will take place and the staff will be recommending a diverse range of strategic plans to address the budget gap. Public consultation on the budget, which will begin in early Jan 2012, will include an open house event at City Hall, a survey, information posted online, and a public hearing on an interim budget plan. A final budget plan will be presented at the end of March 2012. This Thursday in Ottawa, Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird delivered a stark warning to roughly 5,000 Canadian citizens in Syria to get out of that country as soon as possible, pointing out that the Canadian embassy in Damascus won't be there much longer to help them. Federal officials said they estimate there are roughly 5,000 Canadian citizens in Syria, though only 1,512 have registered with the embassy in Damascus, most of them being dual citizens. However, the minister did say that he does not have a plan to close the Canadian embassy in Damascus, quote, at this time. The escalating violence in Syria, combined with sanctions that have reduced the number of flights out of the country, have forced Ottawa to declare a voluntary evacuation from the country. According to the UN, more than 5,000 people have died in the past 7 months, a result of a shocking crackdown on protesters by the Syrian military, who have been given shoot-to-kill orders by the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. In local news that's in tune with the holiday spirit of giving, a group of grade 7 students from Quilchena Elementary School in Westside, Vancouver, held bake sales and raised $500 to buy non-perishable snacks for students in need at Queen Alexandra Elementary School. Queen Alexandra, which is a east side school located at the corner of Clark and Broadway, is surrounded by social and Aboriginal housing. Many of its students come from families who live below the poverty line, unable to afford snacks or warm clothing. One of the students' parents was so impressed by their efforts, she helped organize a clothes drive. And now bags of secondhand clothing are being given to Queen Alexandra Elementary School, where the school donates them to families struggling to find the items they need to survive. The school's Breakfast Club program that feeds as many as 60 students out of the school population of 190 has also been seeing parents showing up hungry. That program has been partly funded for the past 18 years by the Vancouver and District Labour Council. Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Are you walking to class? Are you grabbing a coffee? Got lunch hour to kill? We invite you to fill the silence of your day with the sound of some live music. Music on the Mind? UBC's newest student concert initiative invites the School of Music out of the concert hall into the schoolyard. 10 concerts at 5 venues on one campus. Let's get music on the mind at UBC. For more information, visit ubcmusiconthemind.com. Sponsored by CITR Radio, Vancouver, BC.
Said I thank you, thank you. Said I thank you, yes I thank you.
And I thank you.
Thank you, thank you.
And I want to thank you.
My mama thanks a million.
The music says it all, but we'd like to say it again. Thank you, from all of us at CITR, for your generous support during our 2011 Fund Drive. We just couldn't do it without you.
You made a million dreams come true, and so I'm saying thank you, a million to you.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the national news. The tourism community of Saugeen Shores, Ontario, has announced it is considering playing host to 48,000 tons of Canadian nuclear waste. This community is the ninth to express interest in this deal, which features a proposed 375-hectare underground bunker located half a kilometer underground. The project would cost an estimated $24 million, providing many jobs for the community. This project would alleviate stress on temporary storage facilities in the surrounding areas, including the Bruce Power Plant, which houses 40% of Canada's nuclear waste. Ottawa Piscot Chief Teresa Spence is requesting an injunction to remove any third-party management from the community's finances. The federal government is forcing the Attawapiskat First Nation to pay a private sector consultant about $1,300 a day to run its finances, even though the government's own assessments say the third-party management system is not cost-effective. The total cost would amount to around $300,000, which would be enough for at least one well-built family home in the community. Further discussions are ongoing between the community leaders and the Canadian government. Those were your brief national headlines. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is News 101. And it's now time for the international news. For the international news, we'll go straight to Free Speech Radio News for their daily international news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A Justice Department investigation found that the Seattle Police Department has engaged in a pattern and practice of excessive force that violates the Constitution. When police do use force, they do so unconstitutionally about 20% of the time. The Justice Department also found that officers resorted to the use of impact weapons like batons 50% more often than they actually should, given the magnitude of the individual situation. Jenny Durkin, U.S. Attorney for Western Washington, spoke at a press conference today.
You see in other areas and other departments that there is a way to supervise adequately those officers who are using force, and particularly those who are using it time and time and time again, to make sure that that officer is not put in a position where he has to use force over and over again. And whether there is training that could help, whether there's tactics that could help, whether there's even other duties that that officer should have. And so really, I think that the message police officers in Seattle should have is the vast majority of them are doing their job well and honorably. We owe it to them to get this right.
Community groups called for the investigation after the police shooting of a hard-of-hearing Native American man named John Williams. A woodcarver, Williams was carrying a small knife and block of wood when he was shot 5 times by a Seattle officer. Video of the incident showed 7 seconds separated the time when the officer started to demand Williams put down the knife and when he opened fire. Despite the claims of racial bias from community groups, the Department of Justice investigation did not find Seattle police engaged in a pattern of discriminatory policing. The Securities and Exchange Commission today announced charges against 6 former Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac executives. Investigators accused them of securities fraud, alleging they knew of and approved misleading statements about the risk of subprime loans. The current and former CEO were among those named. But the SEC charges are not criminal in nature, so none of the accused face time in prison. Instead, the accusations are part of a non-prosecution agreement, whereupon the 6 have agreed to accept responsibility for the actions of the companies. Gunmen have killed at least 3 Nigerian Air Force personnel during an attack on a boarding school in the country's restive north. FSRN's Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The attack occurred on Thursday night at a school near the northern city of Kano. An Air Force spokesman put the death toll at 3, but a local doctor reported 4 dead and 2 injured. More than 100 students were in the dorms when the attack occurred. But no children have been reported among the dead. The school is mainly attended by the children of military officers. The Air Force says it is yet to establish a motive for the attack. In recent months, a number of attacks, including suicide bombings, have been carried out in the region by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. The organization is pushing for the introduction of Islamic law in Nigeria. The group has said it targets those working against its interests, especially the Nigerian military, which was deployed to arrest its members. Media reports estimate that the group has been responsible for more than 20 deaths in the north within the past month. Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been granted the right to appeal his extradition order to Sweden. There he faces allegations of sexual assault. The British Supreme Court has scheduled the hearing for February 1st. Assange's lawyers say the extradition attempt is politically motivated and that Sweden will likely release him to U.S. custody, where he may face unrelated charges. WikiLeaks has released hundreds of thousands of classified U.S. documents over the past several years. And finally, controversial journalist and critic Christopher Hitchens has died. Early in his complicated political life, the UK native was a fervent opponent of the US war in Vietnam. He was also a correspondent for the magazine of the Socialist Workers' Party. But after September 11th, his political views seemed to shift as he clashed with Noam Chomsky and Michael Moore over the issue. An outspoken atheist and humanist, he wrote the 2007 book God Is Not Great, How Religion Is Poisoning Everything. The publication arguably made him the most famous atheist in the U.S., his adopted home. Hitchens died of cancer. He was 62. And that's headlines for...
Hundreds of Egyptian protesters clashed with security forces outside the Egyptian cabinet in central Cairo on Friday. Citing witnesses and state TV, Al Jazeera reports more than 200 injured and at least two killed. FSRN's Noel King has this report from Cairo.
Violent clashes between protesters and Egyptian military police began early Friday morning and grew larger throughout the afternoon. A few hundred pro-democracy protesters have staged a sit-in in front of Egypt's cabinet building since late November. Protesters told FSRN that the pitched battle began when one activist taking part in the sit-in was detained by military police and badly beaten. The clashes were confined to a broad avenue leading from Tahrir Square in downtown Cairo and to several smaller side streets. Throughout the afternoon, a handful of men in plain clothes pitched rocks from the roof of a government building onto jeering protesters in the streets below. Other protesters said they were beaten by military police. The protesters armed themselves with stones, pitching them at Egyptian troops. The protesters were mostly young men. Women and older people took part, but most stood a few hundred yards from the front line. One protester, who would only give his name as Abdullah, says he's been part of the cabinet sit-in for several weeks. He says his primary complaint is the Egyptian economy. He's worked as a security guard and has struggled to find work.
I graduated from school in 1995, and since then I've been looking for a stable job at a good company. I still haven't been able to find one. That's why I'm here.
Others are concerned about the political process. 51-year-old Fatah, a housewife, says her husband told her not to go to the cabinet sit-in. She told her husband she was going to her sister's house and rushed to the scene of the clashes instead.
I've been here every Friday since the revolution started in January. I'm still concerned about what's going on here. I want a democracy. I want the military council to step aside.
Egyptians voted this week in a second round of parliamentary elections. 18 of 27 Egyptian governorates have now voted. Conservative candidates have done better than expected. The Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party commands around 40% of the vote, and strictly conservative Salafi parties have taken another 25%. Several protesters expressed dismay that conservative candidates have done so well in the parliamentary elections. Others said they are unhappy that Egypt's presidential election will not be held until July of 2012 and demanded that the election be held sooner. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
Those were your international news brought to you by Free Speech Radio. Thanks to them for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, Free Speech Radio News. To continue the international news here, President Obama welcomed the last American troops home from Iraq on Wednesday. Obama called the ending of the conflict, quote, an extraordinary achievement, and said, we are ending a war not with a battle, but with a final march toward home. As of this week, there were approximately 5,500 troops still in Iraq, down from more than 170,000, which were stationed there at the height of the war, started after the September 11, 2001 attacks. Obama thanked soldiers and their families in Fort Bragg and said he was confident the U.S. departure from Iraq, as well as the eventual transition out of Afghanistan, would leave the United States in a better position overall. The Russian fishing vessel Sparta hit some submerged sea ice earlier today in the Ross Sea near Antarctica. The ice tore a 1-foot hole in the hull and caused the ship to list some 13 degrees. The 32-crew ship has made some efforts to upright the ship, but cannot expect outside help for another 4 or 5 days. So far, there have been no reported casualties. A new report out of The Hague shows that from a surveyed population of 34,000, 1 in 10 people had experienced some form of sexual abuse in their childhood. The report also revealed that as many as 20,000 children suffered abuse at the hands of Dutch Catholic Church institutions over the past 65 years. Sexual abuse of minors, the report said bluntly, occurs widely in Dutch society. The commission was set up last year by the Catholic Church under Wim Dietman, a former government minister. The report also revealed that as many as 20,000 children suffered abuse at the hands of Dutch Catholic institutions. Archbishop Ejik said the victims of the Netherlands would be compensated by a commission the Dutch Church set up last month, which has a scale starting at $6,500, rising to a maximum of $130,000, depending on the nature of the abuse. For another brief headline, we head to Free Speech Radio News where they talk about the last-minute deal at the House of Representatives in the U.S.
In a last-minute deal to avoid another government shutdown, negotiators from both parties in Congress agreed on a more than $1 trillion spending bill late Thursday night. The House of Representatives passed the legislation Friday and sent it to the Senate for approval. Some of the many policy riders on the bill have been abandoned, such as restrictions on travel and remittances to Cuba. But a handful of controversial measures remain, and concerns over transparency moved some lawmakers to vote no. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the details from Capitol Hill.
When the House took up the massive omnibus spending bill, which will fund the federal government through 2012, Republican Rules Committee Chair David Dreyer praised its many cuts to federal spending.
It is absolutely imperative if we are going to get our economy going and create jobs for us to reduce the size and scope and reach of the federal government.
While total discretionary funds will drop to nearly $31 billion below last year's levels, the bill still awards the Pentagon $2.5 billion more for weapons upgrades. The Border Patrol will get $362 million more than last year, and $50 million more will go to ICE. Meanwhile, the budgets of the Education Department, the EPA, and the IRS have been scaled back. California Democrat Barbara Lee criticized the lack of transparency in passing the bill.
Once again, the Tea Party Republican Party used a process that would not allow for full committee hearings and what we call a markup, and I'm on the Appropriations Committee. None of this came before our committee. They did this behind closed doors, and it's a shame and disgrace, and I'm not going to support it.
Though many were scrapped in late-night negotiations, the surviving policy writers in the bill block new light bulb and TV set efficiency standards, require the Department of Energy to use the controversial E-Verify system to check the citizenship of its new hires, and ban Washington, D.C.'s needle exchange and abortion access programs. Congressmember Barbara Lee.
The residents of Washington, D.C., especially women, low-income women, women of color, are taking a huge hit in this omnibus bill. I mean, it's outrageous that the District of Columbia will not be able to use their local funds to provide women access to health services, access to abortions. That is so discriminatory, it's wrong.
A group from Occupy DC came to Capitol Hill to protest the bill Friday morning. Among them were three local activists on the ninth day of a hunger strike for DC statehood.
Such a radical situation like this, where 601,000 people are disenfranchised, where they can't decide how to spend their own money, is such a terrible situation. It takes a radical action to hopefully change it, like a hunger strike.
That's 23-year-old Joe Gray, who has been using a wheelchair since he entered the second week of the hunger strike. Earlier this week, the group met with Minnesota Democrat Keith Ellison, who announced Friday that he would go without food for 24 hours in solidarity with the Occupy DC activists. Fellow hunger striker Adrian Parsons told FSRN that unless the district fights for full representation and autonomy, it will continue to be used as a political pawn.
DC is vulnerable to attacks like this. where Congress can go ahead and get something that they believe is a policy directive or maybe a moral directive and place it strictly within a 10 by 10 square mile border that has no representatives and they feel that they represent because they work here. Unfortunately, this has been going on for 200 years.
Parsons was later arrested along with members of the group DC Vote for blocking the street by the House office buildings. Meanwhile, the National Defense Authorization Act has been sent to the president's desk. Civil rights groups have spoken out against the provisions allowing indefinite military detention of anyone suspected of supporting terrorism. But during Thursday's Senate debate, South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham defended those provisions, saying those accused have forfeited the right to due process.
We think Al-Qaeda operatives, citizens or not, are not common criminals. We think they're crazy people. Warriors bent on our destruction who would blow themselves up just as quickly as they would blow you up.
The bill was passed by Congress Thursday, the 220th anniversary of the ratification of the Bill of Rights. Some groups are still calling for a presidential veto, even though the White House has said the changes made to the bill this week took care of any major concerns. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
That was Free Speech Radio News. Thanks to them for bringing us that international headline. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, freefsrn.org. Well, up next, News 101 is happy to have right here in our studio, Alex and Sam.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us.
These are two senior student researchers from the School of Communication at Simon Fraser University, and they're part of 13 senior students at SFU who took part in a NewsWatch Canada seminar under the supervision of Dr. Kathleen Cross, and where they focused their academic attention on mainstream and independent news sources between September 2010 and August 2011. So here to discuss that report called Missing News, the Top 25 Underreported Stories, is Alex and Sam. Welcome to News 101.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for having us.
Well, when I first looked at the top 25, I honestly wasn't surprised because, you know, I'm an independent journalist. I could claim that. And I go through the news on a daily basis and I see these things are not there. And so tell us, what was the root of this project? Where did it start? What were you inspired by? Or were you frustrated by things?
Well, NewsWatch Canada has been around since the early 90s. It started with Donald Gustine and Robert Hackett at SFU, and now it's grown into kind of an annual seminar at SFU. It looks at a different topic each semester. This semester was the missing news, but previously it's looked at gender, race, and poverty. But specifically this semester, we were looking at what stories were going unreported in the mainstream news and why this was occurring.
Yeah, definitely. The way we pulled all these stories together was we went through the alternative media first, and we had a criteria for the stories. They had to be of international or national importance. They had to affect a large number of people. It had to be relevant to our time frame, and it had to be reported at least once somewhere. So we had to at least know of the stories. And then based on that, we compared these alternative stories to how they were covered in the mainstream. And from that, the students and our faculty at the communications department at SFU and also our national panel of judges comprised the top 25 missing underreported stories of 2011.
So tell us, did you go through different media like TV, print, radio, or did you focus on the digital?
It was mostly digital. What happened was Kathleen Cross came with us with numerous independent and alternative news publications. Some were available online, some were available print. And then each student got between 3 and 4 sources. And then we looked at those from our given time frame, going through each article, looking at each story, and then we brought them to the class. And then the class would go from there, deciding the top 100.
So a lot of the stories were influenced also by what the students were interested in.
I wouldn't say influence, but it was definitely we had our own researcher bias.
But because we knew we had these biases, we would disclose them in the seminar, and also we would have these criteria and also the faculty decisions and the national panel decisions. So we wanted to balance out the biases.
So going through this list again, were both of you or was your team surprised by the results? You know, did you see topics on the list that you said, why isn't this being talked about more?
I think the majority of the stories we would go as a collective, as a class, we'd just be outraged, I think, was the emotion we felt most of the time. We didn't understand why issues of such importance weren't being given to the general public. And then once you look at really why they aren't, it gets really frustrating. And I think a lot of us were just kind of depressed at the end of each round of stories because we realized that these affect our daily lives and they're not getting out there to the general public.
Before we whittled down the stories to the top 25, we actually had 153 of these stories. So Wow. We would continually present them to the class and be like, wow, this is amazing that they aren't getting reported. And I remember this one girl, she was making a search on the mainstream news. She's like, this isn't coming up in my search. Either my search is broken or the mainstream news is broken. So that's exactly why we did this report.
And do you think some of the stories are there because some of them are taboo to talk about generally in the mainstream media? They're afraid to talk about those issues. For example, Islamophobia and the FBI. That is something you wouldn't bring up in the mainstream because it's something that they think they need to look over in order to... I'm not sure what they want to do, but that is something we need to talk about.
I think the problem is that once we bring it up, there's a general discussion about why there is Islamophobia. If we bring it up, then we actually have to talk about why it exists. Yeah. And I don't think us as a society right now are ready to realize that we as Canadians aren't necessarily as great as we want to think we are.
Definitely. I think most of our stories have to deal with either unethical corporate practices or environment or health. And it's very difficult discussions that we need to be having about these stories.
And I think another problem is now a lot of the PR runs our newsroom. And if we start putting stories about how there's all these oil wells in Alberta that are going unclaimed because there's a lot of influence from the industry, then we have to start questioning how the private and public sphere are working together.
Right. That is one of the problems of journalism today, is that the information that we receive has been filtered several times before it reaches us. And so we find it hard to get to the source. We find it so hard that we begin to rely on tertiary sources and not even secondary, you know?
And I think the sources that we're getting at are becoming fewer and fewer. Like, we have to realize that newsrooms are shrinking, and what used to be a story that 10 people would work on is now being done by one person, and it has to be turned over in a matter of hours. Mm-hmm. And so we're losing a lot of that core information, and kind of we're filling it with fluff.
Yeah, and that one person could have simply Googled it and submitted it, you know?
And I think something that we need to make sure of is that when you bring up the point of news being filtered, it's sometimes not even a conscious thing that journalists do. So no journalist is going to go, this is a really important story, but I'm not going to cover it. But what is probably more likely to happen is that this journalist has a deadline, they have a very few set of resources due to budget constraints, and therefore they'll say, well, I'll cover this cheaper and easier to do story than probably this really important one that's really complicated. And so that's one way that news gets unconsciously filtered out.
I know one thing that Bob Hackett, who works with NewsWatch, was telling us, is that we have to give a lot of the credit to the journalists who do cover the stories that go underreported, because a lot of times they're putting their career and their reputation in conflict with what the organization they work with.
Right.
Because sometimes they put out stories that the people that are paying them don't want them to put out, and they can lose their jobs and lose their careers.
Have there been cases like that where the journalist in particular was shunned? Or
definitely, you know? I think a classic case was when a bunch, I think two Fox reporters, I think last decade, they wanted to report on bovine growth hormone
right.
in milk, and they got fired. It was pretty outright censorship. But again, we don't see too many cases of outright censorship here in Canada, but you do get, again, these unintentional filters.
So going through this list and just remembering what Dr. Kathleen told you, are we frustrated about the way journalism, modern-day journalism, handles topics like this? I mean, why do you think they are afraid to push those boundaries? I'm sure it might be funding, which is very important for most agencies as a company, because companies work based on profit and loss and things like that. But why are we afraid to push these boundaries?
I think there's an example. I was in a tutorial and we were talking about apartheid, and then the TA said, in Canada, we don't get segregation amongst poverty lines like that. We don't see that like in other countries. And my first reaction was, of course we do. Homeless people, 30% of homeless people are Aboriginal, whereas Aboriginal comprise of only, what, 1 or 2% of the population. This is apartheid for sure, but If we tackle that head on, we'll have to realize something really horrible about what's going on in our own backyard. That is a really, we like to think that maybe we're better here in Vancouver than whatever other city, but right.
I think, yeah, us as Canadians like to put ourselves on a pedestal. Right. We like to think that because we come from this democratic society that we are somehow better than other countries, but when you look at it, because these stories aren't being put in, us as a country, as a democratic society, we're kind of losing that democracy.
Right. Yeah, these stories seem to break that bubble that we're in, you know, that sort of, well, most people, when they talk about Apple, for example, they say people in Apple and are in a bubble, you know, and so same case here. I have right here in front of me Epoch Times. You might be familiar with it. I read it all the time. And these guys are very good at bringing out the news that's important. You know, they're very good at breaking the bubble, at writing things that no other news agency would ever write, you know. And I'm really glad that there are students like you, and of course courses like
Communications 431.
Absolutely, I think I'll go for it eventually. But there's one thing that we need to talk about, and that is that how do journalists, I mean, I'm asking you a suggestion. How do journalists filter a torrent of information that they are being flooded by, you know? Constantly, on a daily basis, the public is, the media is, and of course the media is a subsection of the public, but we're constantly being flooded by information from news agencies, and we then in turn seem to take that for granted, assuming that they've checked their facts, and then we forward it or share it on Facebook or things like that. How do we filter this information? Has Dr. Kathleen talked about that?
Definitely. I think journalists look for stories. Again, this is not any intentional malpractice that they intend to do, but as a journalist, you want to forward your career. And so you think, well, I'm going to look for the story that will grab the most attention, that'll be the most dramatic and personalized, have a human interest, that will get a large audience, and which in turn will make my editor happy because it will... large audiences tend to attract advertisers, right? So it's not any intention of doing wrong, but this is just how the news structure in mainstream news gets...
Unfortunately, yes.
And I think there's the... With the sensationalized stories, it's all this, like, soft news and the celebrity news. And there is a lot of talk about how we can change this, but a lot of people think that we can't do anything. But in terms of the news is ours, and if we want to take it back, then we have to come together and do something and support good journalism and support alternative media and actually stop talking about it and actually do something about it and support our public broadcaster and support all these other mediums that are showing the news that we need to be able to function in a democratic society.
Right. I mean, how important do you think independent journalism is in this case? I mean, to report on stories like that.
Yeah. I thought it was amazing to, like, sometimes when I read stories from mainstream news, I say, oh, this looks pretty thorough. It seems to have all the information. But when I look at the alternative news, I'll be like, wow, there's this whole other aspect.
A whole other angle.
Right? So that so we need to have alternative media to be sort of the watchdog for the watchdog.
And I think more is we need more people to know that alternative media is out there. Even some of the students in the class weren't aware that these outlets were available to them at just the click of a button with the internet. So many people think that just because they watch CTV, they're informed, but that's not the case nowadays. You have to go out there and seek the information for yourself.
Right.
And it's really not that hard. The internet provides us with multiple of avenues where these independent stories and these independent journalists are posting their own stories.
Although at the same time, it is easy to get lost in the internet too.
Very, 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 very true.
So, is your team interested in exposing more stories or taking these stories to a new level? I mean,
Well, I'm actually working with Dr. Kathleen Cross next semester, working on the website and getting all of our 100 stories out there to a publishable product. So definitely in the future, News Watch is going to be publishing like this seminar will be occurring next year, but next semester, more specifically, I'll be working on this, our case, and making sure that the 100 stories are being more researched, more thoroughly researched.
Alex?
Definitely. I think, personally, I will just continue to support alternative news and to contribute whenever we can.
And is there any way for the federal government, for example, to take this into account and possibly eventually do something? Because something needs to be done about these stories, right? I mean, of course, on one hand, there are stories, but stories are based on fact. And as we know now in our world, everything's beginning to deteriorate. The environment, public perceptions of the government, of financial institutions. So something needs to happen, and somebody needs to act on these things.
I think the first thing is the federal government can make sure that CBC doesn't go anywhere in the near future.
Right.
And I also think that the federal government needs to kind of keep away the sticky fingers, because I think sometimes they are influencing the news and what's being put out there. And if we want the full story, we need to make sure that they're not being influenced by the government or Harper and the conservatives.
And the government can also prevent too many monopolies from happening. What happens is lots of corporations are converging. And so you can have, for example, Bell, which owns newspapers and radio stations at the same time. That means they will never critique anything anything unethical going on in their own corporations, right? So there's conflicts of interests that the government should regulate. And also there are laws that prevent journalists from saying untrue things on the air. I think they don't have that in the States, which is why Fox gets away with so much.
That's true.
So these are things that the government can regulate in Canada.
Absolutely. And would you like to tie this to the Occupy movement? On News 101 here, we've been talking about that for a while. We've had professors on to talk about it. We've had, members of the Occupy Vancouver here to talk about it. But clearly, there are stories here that link in to what they have been trying to talk about.
Definitely. One of the first things that Occupy in New York did was when they hit the ground, they started fundraising for their own newspaper, because you need to have an alternative news in order to grow your base, right?
And also Occupy Wall Street Journal?
Yeah. I don't know if that's still running, but again, it shows that the news is really important, and that you need to have news that reports on all aspects of a story.
Great. So that was Alex and Sam from Simon Fraser University, who were part of a team of 13 senior students who took part in a Newswatch Canada seminar under Dr. Kathleen Cross. So would you like to tell us where our listeners could get information on this report, maybe a web link?
Yeah, if you go to pages.cms.sfu.ca/newswatch,
right.
You can find the whole report along with all of the history of Newswatch Canada and the more information on the directors.
Absolutely. And if you Google it, I'm sure there are several media outlets reporting on the story, and they do have links, as far as I remember.
Yes, the Georgia Strait actually covered it right after our presentation and report came out.
That's great. Well, thank you both so much for being on News 101.